Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we will jump in right away this morning with U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who is making news today with some rare public criticism of Governor Cuomo on ethics. The reason Cuomo is disbanding the so-called Moreland Commission on Public Corruption that he had impaneled. The U.S. attorney calls the commission's work aggressive but incomplete. U.S. Attorney for New York, Preet Bharara, joins me now in our studio. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
Why are you going public with this disagreement with Governor Cuomo?
We sent letters upon finding out that a very important body was being decommissioned prematurely and earlier than it was indicated that it would go on for. And I, you know, took the time and effort to write letters to the commissioners. I had a good meeting with the two remaining chairs of the commission yesterday who made the determination that if they weren't going to be permitted to continue the work that they had started with, you know, a lot of excellent commissioners and dedicated staff, that someone should get all the files and someone should get all the leads and someone should get all the documents so the investigation could continue. And they determined that the best place for that to happen was in my office.
Now, your letter to the governor called the Moreland Commission's work active, aggressive, ongoing, but incomplete, which is at the heart of your criticism. In what ways was it aggressive? What has it accomplished, in your opinion, that you hope to further?
Yeah, we were borrowing terms that were used by the folks who established the Moreland Commission in the first place. And if you go to the website of the Moreland Commission and you look at the report that the Moreland Commission issued itself and you look at the statements made at the time of its establishment, it was done with a lot of fanfare. And it was done in a way to make the public believe, and we'll see if this ends up being true when we look at the documents, but in a way to make the public believe that it had an active, ongoing investigation, some of which should or would result in criminal charges. And when that is announced with great fanfare and then along the way with additional fanfare and then it seems to be unceremoniously shut down early, then I think, you know, thinking people wonder why that happened and want to get to the bottom of it. I mean, the bottom line for us is we are prosecutors and we care deeply about public corruption. At the time that the Moreland Commission was established, I think it was clear that in part it was because of a lot of the cases that the fine career prosecutors in my office brought. In fact, it was almost exactly a year ago last week that we brought a number of significant cases against sitting officials in Albany and elsewhere. And that's why the commission was established. I was invited to be the first witness at the Moreland Commission's first public hearing. So obviously, people in our office have a sincere and strong interest in making sure that prosecutions and investigations are followed through on.
Listeners, questions or comments for U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, post them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Would it be fair to say, however, that the commission was impaneled to investigate and to make recommendations, both of which it did? It was not impaneled to prosecute. So in a way, its work is complete?
The facts are that the commission was established for a period of time. And I understand it was not going to be in perpetuity, but it was clear that it was going to be established for a year or 2 years. And there was talk – if you look at the website even I think today or yesterday, you see that they're talking about – a future report that was going to be issued, I think, in 2015. So I think the plain facts are that it was disbanded before its time. You know, 9 months may be the proper and natural gestational period for a child, but in our experience, it is not the amount of time necessary for a public corruption prosecution to mature. And you know, sometimes when you hear about the cases that my office has brought and other offices have brought, it can take a year, 2 years. You know, the important thing now is that as we speak, folks from my office and investigators are going over to the commission to collect the documents, and we'll see what they are, and we'll go through the files. And if there are cases to bring that are appropriate for us to bring, we'll bring them. If they're appropriate for us to further refer to local and other federal prosecutors, we'll do that. So, you know, we just want to get our hands on the files and make sure that the work is getting done, because that was not clear to me last week.
U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, critical of Governor Cuomo for being, in effect, soft on ethics, for disbanding the Moreland Commission that the governor had impaneled. Here's a little bit of the governor's case. I want to play a clip of his right-hand man, Larry Schwartz, on this program last week. I asked him about this very thing, and he said Cuomo's ethics reform efforts had been robust enough to let the Moreland Commission go and had been successful enough. Listen to Larry Schwartz.
And with the Moreland Commission, the governor got the Public Trust Act passed, okay? And that's why he created the Moreland Commission, because the legislature was unwilling last year to do ethics reform. And by through the Moreland Commission, we got a new, tougher bribery statute. We got new crimes for corrupting the government put in place. Public officials who are convicted of a felony or elected officials will be debarred from holding public office for life. Vendors, contractors, people that do business who defraud the government will be barred for life from doing business with the government. We got independent enforcement at the Board of Elections. We got increased disclosure of outside income by elected officials. And we got, for the first time in history, the Senate to agree to use public funds, you know, at least in a controller's demo project. For 30 years, there's been an ongoing effort to get the Senate to agree to public campaign financing in terms of using public funds. The governor was able to convince the Senate to go along as a first step to use unclaimed funds, which are public funds, in a controller's demo project, and to evaluate how well it works, and then to go from there.
All right. Larry Schwartz, Governor Cuomo's right-hand man on this program last week. That's a long list of accomplishments that he laid out there. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, it's terrific. That's a terrific speech. And, you know, legislation is good. I don't think legislation is a panacea. And I think, you know, there are people in the public who appreciate that a lot of things were not accomplished legislatively. But from where I sit, when you begin something, you finish it, particularly when you're telling everybody that you're going to finish it. And if you begin investigations and you begin them with great fanfare, you don't, I think, unceremoniously take them off the table without causing questions to be asked. And in a world in which public corruption remains a serious problem and there are investigations that have been begun, you know, they should be finished.
If this ethics commission is still needed, what do you think the governor's motive is in disbanding it? Is he ethically challenged?
I'm not commenting on anyone's motives or what their you know, what their plans are. What I'm saying is that as prosecutors in this state who have done a lot of public corruption prosecutions and care about it, and whose cases are arguably the cause for the Moreland Commission to be established in the first place, I mean, it would be as if you know, we brought our cases, the Moreland Commission gets established, and we said, well, you know, hip, hip, hooray, there's a commission now. We didn't shut down our public corruption unit. And so what's important is, as I've said a couple of times, is that we get the files and see what needs to be done. And I think it's up to the public to ask questions about why this commission was disbanded early. And more importantly, you know, you should have perhaps some of the commissioners and the chairs on the show and talk to them about how they feel that their work was cut short, and I think they have fairly strong views on it from what I understand.
But why do you think? I mean, as a prosecutor, you deal in motives all the time, and I think the suggestion that you're making between the lines is that the governor traded away a strong ethics investigation for short-term political gain in the budget. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is I don't know what facts will come to light once we look at the files, and I don't know what went on and what deals were struck. I think in a letter that I sent to the commission, it said there was an appearance that cases were being bargained away in exchange for a political deal. But I don't know the answer to those questions. And I think those are legitimate questions for people to ask, and maybe we'll be asking them also.
There's also a question now about the governor meddling with the content of the commission's work. This was brought up in the New York Times today. They're supposed to be independent of him once he appoints them. But the Times says in September, Cuomo had at least two private meetings with the chairman of the commission, according to records of his daily schedule. In one instance, it says, Mr. Cuomo's office persuaded the commission to delay issuing a subpoena to the Real Estate Board of New York, whose leaders donated to the governor's campaigns and supported a business coalition. Also, the Committee to Save New York that spent millions of dollars on advertising in support of his agenda, quoting from the Times. So is that in and of itself potentially an act of corruption, influencing a supposedly independent ethics commission to delay subpoenas against his big campaign donors or backers?
Yeah, I don't know what all the facts are there. What I can tell you is it is impossible to overstate the importance of independence on the part of any investigative body, and that is particularly true when you're talking about investigative bodies whether they're the Public Corruption Unit in my office or something like the Moreland Commission, for there to be independence. Without independence, the public does not trust what investigations are taking place, does not trust what prosecutions are brought, does not trust what results are gotten from those investigations and prosecutions. And so people should take very, very seriously any suggestion, and I take them seriously when people suggested about our office or any other office in the Justice Department, that there was either influence or interference. You know, when my public corruption unit operates, it has to operate without fear or favor, without reference to what political party the targets are from, without reference to what editorial pages are saying, without reference to what people's personal ambitions are. And I think we have a sterling reputation in that regard. If you want to ask questions about whether or not independence was undermined, I think, again, those questions are best directed to the commissioners. And I don't know, you know, what the facts are behind some of the things that at least one commissioner or more than one commissioner have been saying in the paper. But I think, again, as with other areas, those are important questions to be asking.
But based on what you just said, would you be opening a formal investigation, an ethics investigation into the governor based on what happened at those meetings?
I'm not going to prejudge what we'll be looking at, what we'll be investigating, and you know, where the facts will lead. What I'm saying is we are just now getting the documents. We're just now thinking about who we need to talk to and what interviews to conduct. And the most important thing is to get the files that the chairs of the commission thought were, you know, best placed in our hands.
Does that mean you're considering and you think there might be cause for an investigation by your office of ethics questions regarding the governor in those meetings?
I appreciate that you've now rephrased the question four times, Brian. But what I'm saying is we're going to look at the documents. We're going to see what the facts are. And if there are questions that are appropriate to ask, as I think the public knows by now, there are strong-willed and aggressive but fair people in my office who will ask those questions.
U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, our special guest on WNYC. You can post your questions or comments for him at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have a few coming in. What are you looking for mostly? The Times cites some people who say there isn't much of substance left incomplete by the commission. So how specifically can you identify what you want to follow up on from their work?
I don't know yet, Brian. We haven't gotten the documents. Literally, they're being transferred, I think, in the next couple of hours. So we'll see. We'll see what's there. I mean, I'm not prejudging and suggesting that, you know, 45 smoking guns exist in various files. You know, maybe there's, you know, there's something serious. Maybe there's not. Maybe there are a lot of serious things. Maybe sometimes a lead that did not look like a big deal to investigators who only had a short amount of time to look at them turned into be a much bigger deal. That happens in investigations all the time. And I won't know until I have people who work in my office and who I trust and who are career prosecutors and who are independent take a look at those things.
Are you going to use some of those 24 commissioners who the governor disbanded?
You know, it's possible. You know, I've made it clear to the chairs of the commission that if there are resources that can still be provided and there are people with expertise who worked on some of those matters, that we try to figure out a way to work with them because we don't want to reinvent the wheel. But, you know, we'll have to see.
Is this political on your part? You know, we just talked to Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker yesterday about his article this week with stories of how Governor Christie, as U.S. attorney in New Jersey, undertook high-profile corruption cases with very political targets to enhance his career, helping to set up his run for governor. How do we know you're not doing something like that?
I don't have any interest in politics. And if you look at the track record of our office, we take on big targets all the time. I mean, as we speak, the sentencing of SAC Capital is taking place in a federal courtroom in our district. In the last 3 weeks alone, we took on Toyota Motor Corporation, perhaps the biggest car manufacturer in the world, and got a settlement with them for $1.2 billion, which I think is transforming the way recalls are done. And you're reading about that every day in the paper. A couple of days later, we convicted five of Bernie Madoff's cohorts in the biggest Ponzi scheme the world has ever seen. The day after that, we convicted Osama bin Laden's son-in-law on material support of terrorism charges. So, you know, whether you're Al-Qaeda or a large corporation or a political figure, we will go where the facts lead, and it has nothing to do with anybody's personal ambition.
You said you're not interested in politics. Does that mean I shouldn't expect to ever see you in that chair as Senator Bharara or Governor Bharara or anything like that?
You should not.
You mentioned Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. What do you think the lessons are of that case, of that conviction, for the future of federal criminal court as a place for terrorists as opposed to military commissions?
I think over time, our office and other offices also, but I think particularly the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office has shown that it is very capable of bringing terrorists to account in civilian court. And over time, we have brought case after case after case, mostly quietly, without a lot of fanfare, without issues of security breaches. And people get convicted, and they go away for a long time, and usually for life. We prosecuted Faisal Shahzad early in my tenure, who was a Times Square bomber. We prosecuted Ahmed Gailani, who was one of the first, the only person brought from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to be prosecuted here. Another guy named Warsami, who was prosecuted here successfully. And most recently, Soleiman Abu Ghaith, who was a right-hand man to Osama bin Laden. And that was done, I think, professionally, as the people in my office always do them. The Attorney General made it a point to come and congratulate the team because they did such a good job. And I think, you know, justice is important and holding people to account is important, but doing it in a way that happens in people's, you know, natural lifetimes is also important. And from the time that Soleiman Abu Ghaith was brought to the United States to face justice to the time he was convicted was about, I think, 13 months. And that, I think, speaks for itself.
Do you think that if there's another big terrorist attack, God forbid, if there's another Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out there someday, that you would like to see that person tried in New York, if New York was the target, rather than in a military commission? Would you go that high up and say, just forget the whole military commission thing? It's harder to get convictions. It gives us a bad reputation around the world. How far would you go in that direction?
Decisions about proper forum, whether military commission or civilian court, are above my pay grade. There are things that are above my pay grade. But I'll repeat what I've told the Attorney General and I've told other people, and that is that our office always stands ready to bring any case, and particularly a terrorism case, if people see fit to send it to us. And we have a track record that speaks for itself, and we've been doing it for a long time. We were doing terrorism cases before other offices in the country even had anyone who knew how to do a terrorism case, and that was done long before I got there. It's been done during my tenure, and it'll be done long after I go. But I do hope the people who are making these decisions take note of the kinds of cases that we have brought and how successful the career prosecutors in my office have been, because I think that's part of the record that allows people to make good decisions about those matters.
Preet Bharara, my guest, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. I certainly don't expect you to comment on whether Governor Christie is guilty of anything in Bridgegate more than has been revealed. But can you, as a U.S. Attorney, give us a glimpse into what the New Jersey U.S. Attorney is probably doing and looking at in its investigation of the matter?
I have enough trouble handling my own job in the Southern District of New York, and I'm certainly not going to give color commentary on what other people are doing, particularly since I don't know what other people are doing. I would not like my colleagues around the country to be commenting on how I'm conducting my investigation, so I would do them the same courtesy.
Any thoughts as a prosecutor on the quashing of the subpoenas yesterday to the governor's aides involved in the lane closures on Fifth Amendment grounds?
Again, I'm not here to give legal commentary. You know, maybe there's a time in the future you can have me on and I can engage in the kind of punditry you sometimes hear people engaging in, but that's not my job yet.
All right. On another topic, you gave a speech recently about the finance industry. So are you still investigating banks or individuals in connection with the financial crisis? And why have so few individuals as opposed to banks as entities been penalized?
We look at a lot of things. You know, we can chew gum and walk at the same time. While we're looking at public corruption cases, we're also looking at terrorism cases. And as you mentioned, we're also looking at large-scale white-collar fraud cases. And the point I made in a recent speech is that, you know, we need to be holding institutions accountable where appropriate and also individuals accountable where appropriate. And the major point I was making is, you know, I think the pendulum in some ways may have swung a little bit too far after the days of Arthur Andersen, where government prosecutors and others may be a little bit too gun-shy about charging an institution when it's warranted. I mean, obviously, the bread and butter of our office and of any prosecutor's office is prosecuting individuals. And if an individual engaged in misconduct and you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt that you can convince a unanimous jury of, you bring that case. But at the same time, sometimes there are institutions where misconduct was pervasive and you have to have an institutional deterrent. That's, for example, what happened with SAC Capital. We charged individuals there, a number of them, and convicted them, and also charged the institution itself, SAC Capital, and that sentencing is taking place now. We're not shy, we're not retiring, we're not unaggressive. But sometimes the facts warrant bringing charges against individuals. Sometimes the facts warrant bringing charges against institutions. The Toyota Motor Corporation case that I mentioned a little while ago is, I think, is a case in point. It's important to bring institutional accountability to bear because it causes that car company and it causes other manufacturers to take a good hard look as a company-wide matter whether or not they should be telling false stories about safety defects and whether or not they should be overly aggressive and appropriately aggressive in recalling cars. And I think the effect of our case against Toyota Motor Corporation is very significant. We brought, you know, in a separate matter, in a bankruptcy fraud matter a couple of weeks ago, which I forgot to mention, a case against a company called Anadarko, in the largest payout to clean up environmental hazards in the history of the country, against, you know, $5.15 billion. So that's, again, institutional accountability, where they could pay to clean up massive amounts of toxicity around the country at many sites. That can't be done by individuals. That has to be done by institutions.
But when is it accountability, and when is it just the cost of doing business? We had former Wall Street executive turned journalist Naomi Prinz on the show this week with her new book, and she had a stat that if you look at the major Wall Street banks and the fines or penalties or deals that have been negotiated with the federal government, that they have paid out 0.8%, 0.8% of, and I forget of what, their assets or however she, or their annual operating, whatever. What, there was a number there, and it was eye-poppingly tiny. So has law enforcement done anything to deter bad or illegal risks again with our national economy as collateral?
I think so. Look, there are a lot of reasons why you want to get large financial components in resolutions with companies. Sometimes it's for penalty purposes, and that's an important purpose, and it should never just be a slap on the wrist and a cost of doing business. But sometimes it's, as I said in the Anadarko case, it's to clean up actual toxic dumps that are in people's neighborhoods and near their homes and sometimes underneath people's homes. And sometimes it's to get money back to victims who lost their life savings. So in the resolution against JPMorgan Chase, which we also had a few months ago in connection with the Madoff scandal, that was an additional $1.7 billion that's going to go to actual victims who in many cases lost their life savings. So that's not nothing for people to get their money back. But when you engage in these resolutions with companies, there are other values that we hold high and important also, like the truth. So in some cases, the money is less important to us than exposure of what happened. You know, we last time I was on the show, I think a year and a half ago, we had just filed a major suit against the Bank of America in connection with their reckless money laundering, mortgage lending practices. And, you know, rather than settle for a certain amount of money with a no admit and no deny, we went to trial against a major law firm in the country and very well-prepared and well-funded lawyers from that law firm, and we beat them at trial. And what got exposed at that trial, I think, is very important. In connection with the Toyota case also, it's not just that the fine was levied. There's a 12-page single-spaced document that sets forth the bad conduct that happened there. And that, I think, is important for the world to see, because part of our obligation is not just to hold people accountable, but for the truth to come out.
Those were all interesting cases. But let me press you one more step on individuals. When the Obama administration wanted to pressure Russia over the Crimea invasion last month, it placed economic sanctions on individuals, top operatives of Putin, by name, rather than merely on Russia as a country, as the most effective way of applying pressure to change behavior. So why wouldn't the government, the same government, use that same standard with people at the top of the banking industry?
You're analogizing to Crimea? Okay.
I'm analogizing the U.S. government, the Obama administration, which I think appointed you, going after people who are seen as bad actors behavior change.
Absolutely. As I said, the bread and butter of what we do is to bring cases against individuals. In connection with the London Whale incident, also involving JPMorgan Chase, we charged individuals. And when we can bring a criminal case that we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt against individuals, we'll bring them. Sometimes there are obstacles to that because we have, I think, the finest criminal justice system in the world. And that puts in a lot of safeguards for people. And you have to prove criminal intent, particularly when you talk about a white-collar matter, when it's not just an eyewitness who sees someone shoot someone else. You have to prove that the things that people did in the filing of documents and representations made were done with a criminal mindset. And that's not always easy to do. I think we've done it more successfully than anyone around, and we're continuing to look at a lot of different things. But I completely agree with the premise that it often is the case that the best way to get deterrence is to bring cases against individuals when they can be brought. Look, in the Madoff case, I think we've now convicted 14 people for an incredibly large and bad Ponzi scheme. And I think that hopefully helps to deter other people who are working at other brokerage firms from engaging in the same kind of conduct. So they're not mutually exclusive. Sometimes you prosecute individuals when you can do so, and sometimes you prosecute institutions, and sometimes you do both.
from our comments page. Nick writes, it is seriously troubling that the New York federal prosecutor's U.S. attorney, Barrara, has chosen not to form a joint task force to deal with the whole question of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Does he really believe that no one at the New York end had any involvement at all? He's talking about Bridgegate.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on how particular investigations in ongoing matters are being handled. I think that I can say fairly, without commenting on how other people do things, that when something is serious and something has gotten the kind of attention that the issue described has, that all hands are on deck.
All right. What are we going to hear from your office next before you go on the Moreland Commission? What's the next step since you brought this to the headlines today?
As I said, there are folks from my office and investigators who are going over to pick up the documents, and we'll look at the documents, and you know, we pursue things aggressively and quickly, but things don't happen overnight. And part of the point that I think I've been making and that others have made is that, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and a commission can't show great success when it was intended to be in existence for 1, 2, 3, or 4 years. For that to happen in 9 months, and it's not going to happen overnight with us either. But if there's something to pursue that's worth pursuing, we'll do it.
And on your own political future, you said you had no interest in elected office. You're a young guy. You're not going to be U.S. attorney for the rest of your life. What are you going to do?
I'm doing this job for as long as I possibly can because I think it's a good and productive job that serves the public, and that's why I do it.
Preet Bharara, U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
really,
Brian. Thanks very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, from banks that are too big to fail, which we were just talking about, we will go to the biggest election on earth taking place right now. Indian Americans, call in and tell everybody else why it's interesting. 212-433-WNYC. Stay tuned.